And I wanted to start off by asking you a little bit about your background and how you originally came to work at NC State.
Okay. Well, first time that I came here was as a student in 1956 after I was discharged from the Navy. And I wasn't able to enroll right away. And I worked in the bookstore until I could enroll that fall. I was married, and we had our first child while I was here. I spent 4 years here as a student, graduated in 1960, and almost immediately began to teach extension courses where I was located. I was working in Burlington. And then I was in graduate school at Duke, and I was continued to be in touch with the people at State, and when they had an opening in the electrical engineering department, they invited me to apply. I was given the offer, and so I joined the faculty in 1968, and I spent 30 years at NC State from the time that I arrived in 68 until I retired in 98.
And you were dean of engineering, I guess, when the Centennial Campus project originally got underway. Is that correct?
Well, I can tell you when I was. I can give you the dates, and I can't remember all of the beginnings and everything. I was head of electrical engineering from 74 to 78. Dean of engineering from 78 to 89.
Right. So you would have been, I guess, dean in those very, very early phases, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your role in that or in those early stages.
Well, I think in the very earliest part, I had no role at all. I don't recall. Chancellor Poulton is probably the only person that knows the earliest activities.
Right.
I do recall that he shared with the deans his concern about the shortage of space and the availability of Dick's property. I know there was some public discussion about it at the time. And at some point along the way, he informed us that there was an effort underway to transfer the property to NC State. I don't know much about how that happened, but there is, as I understand it, once the governor and the chancellor decided that that was something they both agreed upon, that Jane Patterson, who was Secretary of Administration, was key in organizing the transfer so that it would not be one of those long, drawn-out discussions about it happening. So it happened rather quickly. I do recall going down to the old General Assembly Hall in the Capitol Building, at which time the governor and Chancellor Poulton spoke and the official transfer took place. I do believe the Council of State had to approve it, so they would have been an important part of the process to transfer the ownership from, I guess, one department of administration over to the university, and I'm not sure where the university reports in.
So you became interim chancellor in 89?
I did. Before I became interim chancellor, there was a lot happened.
Right.
And maybe you've heard about it, but I was on the committee that began the process of planning. So you may have all of that, and you don't need me to speak to it, but I was on that committee. I don't know how long it was, but it was a very active committee. The chancellor had decided that this was going to be essentially a third-party project. So he brought in the Carley Group, and you probably have all that transition up to the master plan, which this committee reviewed and participated in, the approval by the city and the county, but we didn't get approval by the Board of Governors to make it a third-party activity. So I guess you have that, because that's an important part of the very early stages.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the importance of getting the Carly Group on board since Neil came on this project.
Well, I think they were very helpful because they had done things like this.
Right.
And the fellow who headed that up, who was a, you know, you could tell from the way he handled things that he was a visionary and was excited about this. And I think all of us were excited because the thing that we all wondered about was if the university was going to develop this, we knew the state wasn't going to do it for us. And we were taking ownership of a piece of property in which we had talked about it being multi-use activity and gone so far as to develop plans for it. And there was no way you're going to back out and not be totally embarrassed. So I think all of us wondered just how they were going to be able to do it. And I don't think we ever fully understood how they would develop the resources and to what extent there would be enough return to them that would justify them being the developer. So when that was turned down, that was just a little bit before I became chancellor, interim chancellor. But there was a very, very important event that happened that if you don't have it recorded, you ought to get both parties to tell you, because I don't know which is right and which is wrong. But the School of Textiles, you have that on your notes, the fact that they were going to renovate the building down here.
Yeah, I think I've heard about that.
Well, but the reason it's important is because we needed to put infrastructure on that campus. It was just land.
Right.
And so it was important that we get infrastructure, you know, electricity and water and sewer, as soon as possible. The thing that made that really possible was the insistence of the chancellor that the College of Textiles take the money they had to renovate this building and actually build a new space. Now, the thing that's interesting is that at least to the university, we were led to believe that the dean and the faculty did not want to go.
Right.
Now, as it turned out, as I talked to them in subsequent years, they all felt it was one of the best things ever happened to the College of Textiles. That's good, but it was also one of the best things that ever happened to Centennial Campus, because there was a presence there before any public naysayers could begin to try and erode because we had just put forward this plan, which was not adopted, and everybody was waiting for the next, and the Chancellor Poulton, and that was a very, very brave and a very smart move on his part to say, we're going to put the textile college over there. It was the right move because the vision of it was that it would be a high-technology campus, a technology-driven campus. And it brought textiles into the forefront of leading us in that regard. They were there, they responded, and they did an excellent job in that college in representing the Centennial campus.
And I guess for the most part, to this point, we've been talking about Centennial Campus's development before or right when you became chancellor.
Yeah, I wasn't involved in any of that. I was the one who, when the College of Textiles opened, I was chancellor.
Right.
And I invited Chancellor Poulton and Governor Hunt and others to come and speak on this, and they did, and it's probably recorded somewhere.
Sure.
But that was a moment in the history that really began to make it possible.
Mm-hmm.
What we did is we got the state investment. The state investment helped us with the infrastructure because we had to get it to this building. They made all the right decisions and location to get just far enough away to get enough infrastructure to fill in behind it. So everything was developed, and I suppose Claude probably is the one who made those decisions, he and George Worsley, but they were the right decisions, important ones.
Right. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how your perspective on Centennial Campus changed, how your responsibilities changed as you became chancellor.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a dean, I had a very strong point of view. I thought we ought to make it a graduate campus and really play it up as graduate education. I mean, we, as an institution at that time, and especially in engineering and the sciences, we were not generally recognized as national leaders in those fields. I mean, we had good work, had good people, but our productivity wasn't high enough to get enough attention. And so it seemed to me, as Dean of Engineering, that if we could really put our graduate programs over there, and if we could attract industry, and if we could generate patents and businesses, that campus would be kind of like a beacon, just shining all the time for the state of North Carolina to understand the value that this university has to it in every department. But once the textiles college was put there, my suggestion was put aside, and rightly so, because I began to see that this campus could in fact accommodate undergraduate education. And then I began to talk to my colleagues in engineering, suggesting that instead of just putting the graduate program over there, they ought to move the entire college over there. It'd be a great asset to the rest of the campus, and I can explain that if you wish, but that move is another. It's akin to the textile school going there in terms of its importance for the whole university. And so we can, when you're ready to talk about that, we can. But
I'm ready.
Okay. Well, once I became chancellor and began to see the way the campus was developing, it made sense for me that the institutions on campus who were going to interact most with the development of that campus should be the ones to decide who goes on the campus. So I put a policy in place that for any outside organization to locate on a campus, it had to have a campus sponsor, a college, a department, and that college or department had to establish a relationship with that organization that had some long-term activities. It could be part-time work of students, it could be research grants, it could be intellectual property, it could be education, it could be anything, but it had to be something that entity being there is of value to someone on campus. Some, not one person, but some organization. Having made that decision and put that policy in place, it became clear to me that the undergraduate college over there would be a good idea. It would give their undergraduates opportunities to work part-time with some of those organizations over there, get good experience, and they'd be able to schedule their classes accordingly, and that it would then free up space on the main campus that organizations that wouldn't normally need to be there would be able to expand. First and foremost, the College of Management and Social Sciences, which has always taken space that people vacate. But I put in place before I left a plan that would transition engineering to the Centennial campus, and as they go, would reassign buildings on this campus, and we would tie one building there with a rehab here. So if we build a building for engineering, we'd rehab the buildings they left for them to be occupied, not just give someone the rundown space. And so that's working beautifully. I mean, if you go through the campus, you can see these buildings that have been there a long time rising up beautifully again to be used by colleges that need to be expanding. And so I think all of that move and all the decisions that it forced us to make has really given the university new life. It has life for growth. It has life for specializations that can develop within the space that we can provide it. It has places for graduate education. So it's just opened up the entire university for its future development.
All right. And I wonder how it's sort of, I guess you answered this question probably, but I wondered how as former dean of engineering, you feel like that department, that school is prospering over on Centennial campus.
Well, I don't really know. I mean, they've been over there for a few years. I've been in the space. I haven't looked under the engine, so to speak, and see, well, how many students you got? Well, how much research you got? I haven't looked at that. But I think their attitude, the ones I've talked to, is very positive about, you know, this new space, and it's eventually it's going to pull all the engineering together so that there can be more cross-fertilization among departments and students. And that is something that I desperately wanted to happen. I used to talk to the former dean, who was the one that moved over there, and share with him that the future of engineering is going to be more in the areas between departments than areas in departments, and that getting them in a geographic area where they see each other, lunch with each other, share with each other will really bode well for their future.
And I wonder if you could talk about the importance of private capital, private finance, and developers.
Okay, it became clear after we had built the building for ABB and a couple of buildings. I was the first one to pledge indirect cost money. I was dean to build Research One. We had run out of space. We had two or three large projects coming in. And so I and George Wordley helped me, and we arranged to float a bond and to retire the bond with the research overhead from the College of Engineering. So that was the first building. But that, you know, that's limited in how many of those you can do, because you need some of that overhead to pay for the day-to-day operating expenses of the university associated with that. So you can't pledge all of that to new buildings. I think a few others did it, and we probably, I don't know this, but we probably were getting to the point where that was no longer the way to fund the expansion. Standing in line to get state funding, the Engineering Graduate Research Building was something I worked on for 15 years to get it. And it was just an absolutely wonderful building for the College of Engineering to expand its research and graduate program in, and now has my name, but that's okay too. They'll do well, even though they have to carry that burden. And but waiting in line was not going to move the Centennial campus forward. In fact, there were signals coming back to me from people that I don't need to talk about, asking questions like, well, is that all there's ever going to be over there? Seems to be going slow, doesn't it? Where are you going to get the money? And so it did begin to be a bit of an issue. So I put together a committee, and I think it was probably the new visitors committee that I established at the request of the chairman of the Board of Trustees, Bill Burns, and asked them, along with others, to look at the Centennial campus and to review what we're doing, and to help us get maybe some additional focus activities over there. In the meantime, I had hired Dick Dougherty. And Dick, and I give him credit, but I don't know how much his discussion and interaction with the committee or others did it, but he became a proponent for us looking for third-party financing, getting people to build buildings on this leased land that they would take the responsibility to fill, but we would be the ones that they would have to go through. Well, our concern, and this was why I put this policy in place, if a third party builds a building and rents it out to insurance companies, it may pay for the building, but it doesn't have much value to the university. So it was a very difficult and challenging activity to get a third-party person to come in and agree under those circumstances to build a building with us having to approve their tenants. But we found someone, and Craig Davis should get a lot of credit for being bold enough to take the risk to come forward and win the opportunity to build third-party buildings. We had one other, AT&T came. I don't know who built the building. I don't think we did, but I'm not sure. But now Red Hat is in it. So there's another if it is a third-party built building, it's financed other than through us. So we're not having to carry all that debt of all these buildings, which would have limited our growth rate very much. Now with the new state-funded buildings over there, engineering, the new biotech building, the new science building, all of these are going to be attractions for other kinds of partners to come there, creating a demand for more space. I don't know whether they will go third-party financing or not. There are some things that the Board of Trustees has to worry about. And there is an eventual call on third-party financing. Eventually, the third party will probably want to sell the buildings. That's the usual exit strategy for making any money. Well, in that exit, we'd sure like to know who's going to buy it, and we'd sure want our agreements to stand up the transfer through the transfer. And then someday down the road, it's going to be to the point where purchasing the building ourselves makes sense for our own internal use. So we've got to be paying attention to both of those as this ages. Right now we're in the early stages, but it is ages. Future generations are going to have those things planned and ready to act when the opportunity comes. Now that's third party. That was what you wanted to talk about. Okay, another part of the early activity that goes along with the policy for requiring that there be a sponsor for occupants on the campus was the decision at the time I became chancellor. Claude reported to me, and I decided that he's the planner, and George Worsley was the person that we depended on to execute the financial part of the plan. And there needed to be a third party involved in this, so I reassigned Claude to work with George as the planner and the person that would decide on the finances. And then I placed in the research office the responsibility for approving the customers and recruiting customers to come to that campus. And so we had a sort of a two-party group, that is one that did the planning and the finance and one that worked on occupancy, and we created a committee that we would meet and share. It wasn't a committee to make decisions, it was a committee to work, to share and have a discussion in my presence so that I could stay informed on the issues that we were dealing with. And that was very useful at that period where we were learning how to recruit clients and the decisions that we would have to make as a university to finance and to respond to the clients that were coming there. There were a few other things that we decided to do that were very important. I don't recall exactly who made these decisions, but to create it so that all the employees on the Centennial campus were in an official relationship with the university, and I can't remember what we call it, whether it's an associate but there's a name for it. And I, at that time, they got library privileges. Many of the buildings were on our computer network. I do not know if they qualified for athletic tickets and things like that. That I didn't get down to that level of it. But at the time, it seemed very important, and I don't know if that has sustained itself. But what we wanted to do was to create a community. We didn't want the people coming there to feel as if it's just a real estate deal. We're just leasing them land. We wanted it to be a partnership where we can add value to their business and they can add value to our educational enterprise.
With some of the other people I've talked to in this project, a lot of the focus has been on attracting this first anchor tenant.
Yeah.
I've seen where you've talked about trying to attract small startups.
Yeah. Well, there's been a bit of a division of views on that, and I must tell you, I'll tell you what my view was and still is, but doesn't count anymore. I felt that if we got 8 or 10 big ones, it would be over, and they would overwhelm us. we really would not have anything other than a park, research park. I thought a few large ones that were appropriately chosen made sense, but I felt that the creation of small businesses out of the technology that we develop on campus and with technology in the area that would want to locate there, and with that technology, those small businesses hopefully getting large enough that they don't want to live there anymore, so that we become an industry export organization, so that industries grow up on our Centennial campus and relocate and anywhere. I just thought that that made a lot more sense to me for the Centennial campus to have 100 small businesses than 8 large ones. And I still think that is important for a lot of reasons. You want a turnover on that campus in the sense I don't want people to leave tomorrow, but you want to refresh the campus as the technologies and as the activities that are important to the university change. And that will happen if you have enough small companies that are in specialty areas. It'll either get bought up, it'll get big, or eventually it won't exist. It'll have a useful life. So I just thought that was, to me, unique. It's not a real estate deal. It is an extension of the university to the people of the state through this process of using our technology to create jobs and to create wealth. I still believe that if this university is able to do that and do it as well or better than anybody else, it will change our state, it will change our institution, and we will become a leader in a field that's evolving.